Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and lift off.
Coach on Fire Radio.
I am the
Hello, everybody. What is up? And welcome back to the Flourish and Thrive radio show for episode 10. Kate Hartley here. I hope this finds you well, whatever you are up to today. This is the show where I interview guests whose stories will inspire you to take the steps you need to create the life you want and educate you with tips and strategies to help you overcome your roadblocks. My guests all have one thing in common, and that is the passion to consistently take action, to follow their dreams and achieve their goals in life. On this show, you also hear what's working and not working in people's lives, the challenges they face, and more importantly, how they overcome those challenges, using their resourcefulness to get to where they want to be. Before I get into the details of my inspiring guest today, remember that we would love for you to call in and ask your questions. The number is 646-716-7979. And I'll repeat that again later. You'll be able to listen to the replay of this interview via my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/flourishtherapy.co.uk. You can also find me on Twitter at Kate Hartley UK. So I can't wait to introduce you to my guest today. He is working to transform the lives of people challenged with mental health issues in the workplace. His purpose in life is to ensure that everyone in the workplace feels they have the choice to put their hand up and ask for help if they're suffering from anxiety and depression at work. He is called Jeff McDonald, and I met Jeff via Twitter, actually, a couple of years ago, and have been to some of his Minds at Work meetings, which we'll discuss in more detail later. And that's a network that he co-founded about 18 months ago. At the first meeting, there were just 14 of them, and now it has grown to over 850 individuals. He has some truly inspiring speakers who share their stories of their own individual mental health challenges. And step by step, he's starting to change the way we regard mental health in the workplace. Jeff was the former Global Vice President of Human Resources at Unilever and is now the Executive Director of Open Minds Health, global advocate and campaigner for good mental health in the workplace. He has advised on the Royals Heads Together campaign. He worked with David Cameron when David Cameron was Prime Minister, and also Pope Francis in helping create a more inclusive and sustainable economy. When he's not working, he loves spending time with his family and is a keen swimmer and cyclist. And Jeff has just recently returned from cycling from Land's End to John O'Groats to raise money to break the stigma of mental health issues in the workplace. So without further ado, let's hang out with Jeff McDonald. Jeff, welcome to the Flourish and Thrive radio show. How are you today?
Fine. And this sounds like a wonderful initiative and something that you've got going.
Well,
thank you for having me on.
You're more than welcome. And thank you for sharing your time with me today, because you are really embarking on something that has been an issue within the workplace for, you know, forevermore. And, you know, the fact that you're working on it, the rules are working on it, there's so much more clarity and focus on trying to break through the stigma of mental health issues in the workplace. What kind of got you into this position where you're at now, Jeff?
Kate, I mean, I think it's, you know, like all things that one gets passionate about, there's always a story behind it. And, you know, my own struggles with depression back in 2008 was probably the beginning of this journey, where I was diagnosed with anxiety-fueled depression on the 26th of January 2008, and I'll never forget it because it was my daughter's 13th birthday, and I couldn't celebrate her 13th birthday with her. But, you know, when the doctor diagnosed me, I made a decision which saved my life, and that was not to be burdened by the stigma. And so I asked for help. I told people, and I got the most wonderful support, but more importantly, love from lots and lots of people. And it was that sense of love and support that in many ways kept me alive. And I eventually got myself better after a three-month period. And then in 2012, a very good friend of mine committed suicide. And it was that event catalyzed me into all of this work, because I lay in bed that night and I just thought to myself, you know, if he had had a physical illness, he would have got help and support and probably would have got better. But because he was suffering from a mental illness, or might not even known that he was so ill, he just felt that he couldn't put his hand up and ask for help. And you know, all the research shows that the longer you leave and don't do anything around depression and anxiety, the greater the chance you will take your own life. And I lay in bed that night and I thought to myself, well, you know, stigma has just killed my friend. And that's just not fair. And it was that event which really then catalyzed me into going out into the world and hopefully breaking the stigma so that people truly feel that they've got the choice to ask for help if they're suffering from a mental illness, particularly depression or anxiety.
Was it depression that your friend had at the time?
Yeah.
And was he working at the time as well, Jeff?
Yeah, he was working at the time.
What sort of support structure did he have? I'll say, what sort of support structure did he have? You know, did he have a family, or was he very much, alone in the world?
No, he was a lovely guy. You know, he was the, I have a saying, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. So he was a guy who brought so much light to so many people's lives. He was the life and soul of the party. He was the most gregarious, fun-loving, generous individual. He had a lovely family, happily married, three children. He worked for an organization that had support structures if needed. And most organizations today have lots of support structures in place. But guess what? Nobody uses any of them because they're too scared to put their hands up and say that I'm suffering from, you know, depression or anxiety. But also, you know, I don't always think that it's, I think work has a large part to do with the onset of an illness, particularly in today's very demanding environment. But I also think, you know, we as individuals, we're never taught how to manage and look after our mental health. You know, I was taught dental hygiene. So guess what? My teeth haven't fallen out. But nobody ever taught me any mental hygiene. You know,
yeah,
nobody ever
so
taught
true.
Me mental hygiene. And so, you know, yes, of course he had support and he had people who loved him and all the rest. But what I'm trying to do is try and allow people to ask for help sooner than they get to situations where they're feeling completely hopeless and they might decide that they have to take their own life.
It is, you just brought a very poignant point to life here, is the fact that no matter if the support structures are there and the loving family is there, if that individual doesn't actually reach out and ask for help, then you know it's like taking the donkey to the water, isn't it? Or the horse to the water. You can't force them to drink, and it's by doing what you're doing, you're encouraging people to have the confidence to say, I think I've got a problem and I need help.
Yeah. And not only that, Kate, you know, the other thing that I'm trying to do is I'm really trying to shift the mindset around this whole concept of mental health, because it, you know, just the word mental health, I mean, people immediately, it feels stigmatized and it feels, and I'm trying to shift the mindset around that. So let me just draw the metaphor for you. You know, if you walked into an Adidas store, or if you walked into a Nike store, you would see lots of merchandise being sold, like running shoes and leotards and gym kits, and there'd be all this merchandise available. And then what would you see plastered all over the walls? What do you think you would see on all the walls in a Nike store when you walk in?
Ticks.
What's that?
You know, the tick, the Nike tick.
Yeah. You'd see a Nike tick, but what else would you see?
Healthy people with muscles and sweat.
Exactly. You would see chiseled whippets. You know, we all aspire to those beautiful bodies that you see sweat coming off them, a sixth gear, a toned body. And so you see all these images, and then what do? You rush off and you buy yourself a pair of running shoes or a rowing machine or whatever the case might be, because that's what you're aspiring to from a physical health point of view. When it comes to mental health, what do we see? We see people with their heads in their hands, black and white photographs, people in hospitals or asylums, we just see the images around mental health are not at all aspirational. They're not at all encouraging me to look after my mental health, like the physical health, metaphor that I've just given you. So how do we start helping workplaces and organizations see mental health as a positive thing and as something that is going to help people to perform better, because, you know, they're able to think better, they're able to, and they can only do that by engaging in certain practices, like I decide to go and get my running shoes to be physically healthy. And so we've got to shift both the stigma and the mindset.
That makes so much sense. Do you know, I'd never even thought about it from that point of view, because, we all complain about models being too thin and what message is it giving to our children and, et cetera, et cetera. And those are very, really valid points. But you've just come up with an absolute cracker there, because, when we consider mental health issues, as it were, or mental health on the whole, it's always tagged with grey and depression and sadness and heaviness and kind of hopelessness. Yeah. But it doesn't need to be that way.
Of course not.
So, what did you do when you had your period of depression? Obviously, you're under doctor's help as well. But what did you do personally to kind of lift yourself out of that? Did you change your lifestyle at all, Kate?
I think and I think it's really important for all your listeners as I say this. But what works for me and what worked for me does not necessarily work for everybody else. But I think the message that I would give is that, I took a very holistic approach to getting myself well again. I took medication. So I was on medication. The other thing that I did was I attended, I did some cognitive behavioral therapy. I slowly was able to get back onto my bicycle and start to do some exercise or go for some walks, which in the initial phases of my depression or my anxiety fueled depression, I couldn't even get myself out of the house to go for a walk, but I slowly managed to, get myself out for a walk. So therefore exercise became important. And then one of the most powerful, I think, interventions was, I used to meet probably every 2 weeks with a friend, and he wasn't a friend, he was actually a colleague, who 2 years prior to me being ill was so ill with depression that he had been admitted to the Priory. And, I was never admitted to hospital, but this friend of mine, Martin, was admitted to the Priory. And I used to meet with him every 2 weeks, and I used to see he was better. So I used to sit in front of this guy, and I remember what he was like 2 years prior, and I saw what he was like every 10 days that I used to meet with him. And I saw that he was better, he had his energy back, and he was living his life again. And I kind of looked at him and thought, wow, you know what? You can get through this. You can get better, as long as you stick with, your medication or your whatever therapy you're doing, or some people believe in sort of homeopathic stuff or acupuncture or whatever, but you can get better. And he just gave me that bit of hope, that light at the end of the tunnel, particularly in those dark days when you've got medication and it's not working and it takes ages to kick in and you're going through really dark black phases where you're thinking about whether life is worth living, and you see somebody has come through it and got better, and you kind of think, okay, so this will pass. It will pass. I will get better. So I think it was a combination of those factors that helped me to get better. But then, you know, coming back to your question about, you know, my life today and my lifestyle, is that different? And yes, it is. You know, I do lead my life very differently today as a result of this. And it's taken years, to, you know, to attend more to what I call my physical health, because at the time, yes, I was doing lots of exercise, you know, but my nutrition was not good. My sleep was terrible. I was not recovering during the course of a day. I'd have no recovery time. I had no idea of how to look after my emotional health and do the things that made me happy. I had no idea of how to practice things like mindfulness or meditation, which I do a bit of now. And, you know, back then I probably had no meaning or purpose in my life. And, you know, today I've got so much of that. And it's, I think it's a combination of living my life in a way where I tend to my physical, my emotional, my mental, and having a kind of sense of purpose and meaning. And making sure that I live my life and my lifestyle by employing practices that enhance those aspects of my well-being.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree with that. It is. I think it's a mindset change and a lifestyle change. It's not, you can't quick fix it, because then otherwise I think you just relapse again. And that, I think that's the danger. It's a bit like a diet.
And it's also not, you know, we talk about well-being and the drivers of well-being being physical, emotional, mental, and kind of spiritual purpose or meaning. And, you know, sometimes you go through something like this and you think, okay, well, I better just focus on the physical. But it can't just be the physical. You know, you've got to look after yourself emotionally as well. And, you know, you've got to look after yourself, you know, go and buy the equivalent of your running shoe for your mental health. And you've got to look for ways in which you can be giving rather than getting all the time.
So on that note, what would you advise people to do that are probably, you know, maybe they're feeling anxious, they're waking up with palpitations at the moment. So, you know, they've got that precursor of anxiety related issues starting to build up. What would, from your experience, what advice would you give to Mr. and Mrs. Joe Bloggs as to help them to avoid actually developing depression?
Yeah, look, I think there are two categories. There's some of those people that are experiencing all of this stuff right now, and they've been experiencing levels of anxiety and sadness for a period of time, you know, more than sort of 8 or 10 or 12 weeks, and their behavior has changed significantly. I mean, I would be urging those people to go and see a doctor and just get checked out. And to get to see whether there is a diagnosis around anxiety or depression, and then, you know, follow his or her instructions. And as I said, kind of consider a holistic approach to getting better. I think for those that, you know, are beginning to maybe notice, you know, they've had sort of, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks of constant anxiety. They're noticing that they might be having an easy relationship with alcohol, for example. They notice that their levels of irritability are higher than they normally are. You know, I think for those people, I think, you know, you do need to sit back and you do need to reflect and think about, you know, exactly what you and I have been talking about, Kate, in terms of lifestyle. And, you know, are they doing a bit of physical exercise? Have they had a look to see what they're eating? You know, too much sugar, for example, can really fuel anxiety. You know, I mean, nutrition can be a real, you know, go and see a nutritionist to see whether there's parts of your nutrition that might be fueling some of how you're feeling. You know, sleeping and trying to sleep a little bit longer, even if it's an extra half an hour at night or in the morning, and don't feel guilty that you've got to get yourself out of bed. Have that extra half hour. Learn to recover during the day, you know. And so I think there's stuff at that kind of physical level that I would start really attending to. But then I think there's also stuff at the emotional level, which is, you know, I mean, I think we spend most of our life trying to make everybody else in the world happy. When do we ever spend time making ourselves happy? So when do we ever, you know, really, really be self-compassionate to ourselves, rather than to everybody else in the world? And so I would be encouraging people to think about what are some of those things that make them truly happy, or they feel truly content and do more of that. Practice more of that. You know, maybe it's a gratitude diary that you start to do on a daily basis just to kind of feel grateful for what you've got and the fact that you woke up the next day. So I think there's stuff that are kind of what I would call, you know, what is the stuff that makes me happy? How can I be? How can I do stuff that, that fuels my happiness? And, you know, if your cup's empty, then you can't pour from it.
Sure.
And then I would encourage people to look into things like mindfulness and meditation and yoga, and, you know, so instead of having that extra meeting once a week that goes until 6:30, stop doing that and go to a yoga class. And do that meeting some other time. But you know, go out there and think about what are some of the things that I could be doing to practice that my mind healthy. I don't know. I know that's a big answer to a very simple question. But you know, it's reflecting on how you're living your life at the level of physical health, emotional health, mental health.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in time, there is something about, you know, am I living a life where all I'm doing is getting? So is there a charity out there that I could be contributing to? Or is there something where I could be going where people feel that I'm needed because I'm giving something? And, you know, that concept of giving rather than getting, I think, can also help. So, yeah.
Oh, I agree with
really
you so much.
Things that people can do. But I think that, you know, but I'd also say to those listeners that have noticed these feelings and these symptoms that I spoke about, and you've had them for months, you know, I really would urge those listeners to go and get some medical attention and get a diagnosis to see what might be going on.
And then from that diagnosis, then you make the necessary changes that you need to make. Because I guess, you know, we all know,
exactly.
I think we all know within reason as to whether we're looking after ourselves or not. And you know whether you're getting a good 6, 7, or 8 hours of sleep, whatever your own personal need is. But I agree with you. I mean, sleep deprivation is a method of torture. So, you know, we know how damaging that can be if we're not sleeping functionally. And like you say, nutrition is so important because essentially it's not just feeding our body, it's feeding our brain. And if we're sticking the wrong stuff in, then how on earth is our brain going to cope? And I think support structures are also really important, and connection.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's why voluntary work, for instance, even if you're busy, just to allow two or three hours a week and just volunteer, because it gives you a purpose, and it's amazing what you get out of it. Despite the fact you're not earning money, it's worth its weight in gold. So
I think
now
thing,
obviously
the other thing, Kate, just the other point is when I think about the onset of when I got really ill, and that onset, you know, I had no idea really that I was ill. If it hadn't been for a significant panic attack in the middle of the night, I probably would never really have known that I was ill. And you know, and I think that is also because we seldom in touch with our emotions and how we're feeling. And so I think it's also really important, you know, to begin to recognize your emotions and you know, whether they're emotions of irritability or they're emotions of anger or the emotions of sadness, and whether those are, you know, you're experiencing those more and more. But you know, I was so illiterate when it came to that sort of stuff. And I think part of people catching themselves early in hopefully not getting ill is getting in touch with those emotions and kind of getting a sense of how I'm feeling and why I'm feeling and how often am I feeling like this.
That is so true. And actually, that's just sort of made me leapfrog a little bit to your involvement with Prince William, Prince Harry and Catherine, because what was your involvement with their Heads Together campaign? Because that's all about talking about your emotions, and particularly Harry, who struggled so much after Princess Diana's death. You know, he said he'd bottled that up for 20-odd years, and now he's talking about it, and he's realizing that it's benefiting his life by allowing his emotions to flow. So what was your input with them as an organization?
Yeah, look, I got involved with the Heads Together campaign through a meeting that I asked David Cameron to convene for me back at sort of early 2016 with a bunch of of CEOs who he very kindly agreed to convene. And we got all these CEOs around the table and began to ask them, you know, what were they doing in their workplaces to address the stigma around depression and anxiety. And one of the CEOs around their table was a guy by the name of Sir Ian Cheshire, who at the time Sir Ian Cheshire. And, you know, he used to be the CEO of Kingfisher. And anyway, he was one of the CEOs sitting around the table. And afterwards, he sort of came to me and said, Jeff, look, I'm the chairman of this, you know, this charity, this campaign that the Royal Foundation are about to embark on, which is called Heads Together. Because the Royal Foundation are the three royals, it's their charity. And they decided that they would spend a year campaigning around mental health. And so he just asked me whether I would, you know, give some advice to how to go about or how to pitch the campaign, particularly with some relevance to the workplace. You know, because one of the things that Prince William was very, very keen to ensure was that it wasn't just a campaign, but that it was also then, it had some messages around, well, what could you do about this? So if you were in the workplace, what is it that people in the workplace, leaders in the workplace could be doing to address the stigma? And, you know, so I was advising on, and that's a lot of the work that I'm doing now, is helping organizations think through, you know, what is it that they could be doing in the workplace to address the stigma? So that was my involvement.
I love that because I really wanted to really whittle down with you from, say, an employee's perspective and a colleague's perspective and an employer's perspective, starting possibly with the employee. You know, what do you suggest that can be done within the workplace to help to break down the stigma? So, you know, if somebody's woken up and they've had a panic attack, and they've got to go to work the next day and they really need that salary and they're so afraid of losing their job if they open up to their boss. You know, what do you say to an employee in that situation?
Well, unfortunately, at this moment in time, what I say to them is I ask them two questions. I would say to them, what do they think is the head of HR's perspective on depression and anxiety? And what do they think the CEO of that business thinks about depression and anxiety? And if the answer to those two questions are negative, whereby they think, oh, they don't understand this, and then unfortunately, I say to that employee, you know, just go and see a doctor and you're going to need to sort yourself out and you're going to have to find another excuse as to why you can't be at work because the stigma in the workplace is still intense. And so I think it is about, you know, what is the leadership and the HR's view around this particular issue? If an employee says to me, wow, you know, I work for an organization where it seems like we really, you know, my CEO and HR truly understand this and they're trying to do something about it and creating a more fertile ground for conversations, well, then I would encourage them to, you know, to talk to their boss or to the HR function and to go and see their occupational health function or whatever and get the help and the support that they need. So look, we've still got a long, long way to go in breaking the stigma in the workplace. And, you know, that's been part of my, you know, it's been part of what I'm challenging society in right now in that, you know, I think it's wonderful what the Royals have done. I think it's wonderful what some sportsmen have done in terms of talking about their illness. So you've got people like Marcus Piskorczyk, and you've got Trott, and you've got Johnny Wilkinson, and you've got Rio Ferdinand. So you've got sportsmen, and you've got the Royals, and then you've got some politicians like Alistair Campbell and a number of others doing some amazing work. And then you've got what I call celebrities like Ruby Wax and Stephen Fry. But where are the people from the workplace of the equivalent stature of all those people that I've mentioned? Where are they? You know, it's not as if there's no depression and anxiety in the workplace and that nobody who's leading organizations today hasn't got a story to tell. And that's what's still missing. That's what's still missing is us seeing some significant leaders in workplace settings. And, you know, when I talk about the workplace, I'm talking about the army, I'm talking about the NHS, I'm talking about financial services, I'm talking about the construction industry, I'm talking about broadly the workplace. Where are the leaders from those sectors sharing their stories? And we need more of that to truly, truly help to break the stigma. I mean, it's only part of it, but it's, I think we need to see more of that. And Kate, you saw our Minds at Work thing on the 7th of December.
I was going to say, you started that movement.
Leaders.
Yeah, with your Minds at Work. Just explain to listeners, you know, what's the, because they might not understand what Minds at Work is compared to Open Mind Health. And yes, I mean, I've been so impressed with Minds at Work. And, you know, you are creating that platform that you say there's this huge hole in business leaders needing to take up this mantle.
Yeah. Well, I will come to that, but let me just stay with your other question, because you asked, well, what do you do? I mean, I think then, you know, what do employers need to do? And I think that there are four things that we need employers to start doing more of to address the stigma around mental health. Yeah.
Before you answer on the employer bit, do employees have any laws or rights to protect them within the workplace if they're struggling with a mental health illness?
Yeah, they do. I mean, I'm not 100% sure, but I think they do, and I think that sort of side of the law is getting better. I mean, I know that there's a lot of discrimination around support and help and all that sort of stuff, but I think we are seeing an improvement in that space. But, you know, because there's still such a stigma, Kate, people are scared to actually admit to what's going on, and then what they get fired for is being a bully. Or they get fired for being irritable all the time, or they get fired for missing a lot of work. And so, and you know, maybe they become a bully because they are ill. You know, it just might be that that's part of, they're so irritable, they shout at everybody. I mean, that's part, those are the symptoms of being depressed and or anxious. And so often what happens is people actually end up getting fired for a performance management issue rather than having been able to say, listen, you know, I'm ill, I need help and support, can you look after me?
So it would be interesting,
I mean,
if they actually got fired. I was going
to
say, if they get fired for something like a performance issue, for instance, but they've actually said to their boss, hey, I've got a problem, it's a mental health issue, I need your support, and that support isn't forthcoming, it would then be very interesting to know, you know, how, what sort of stand, because I'm sure they'd have more of a legal stand on that one.
Yeah. Definitely. Now, the employer would be in trouble then, you know, if they kind of had said, look, this is what I'm suffering from. Here's my doctor's report, blah, blah, blah. And then they try to go down the performance management. No, they would be in, they'd be in a lot of trouble. The law would protect the employee.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Well, that's good to hear. So, yeah, go on to employees. What can we do to bully bosses and sticklers that don't want to acknowledge that the mental health issues actually exist?
Yeah, look, I have three things that I would like to see employers doing more of. So for years and years, employers have spent millions and millions investing in health and safety across all organizations. Guess what? All the investment has been in safety, not in health. And I think the time has now come for us to begin to invest in the health and the well-being of employees. So let's make it as important as we made safety, the health and well-being. And so the first bit of investment is, I think that employers have got to educate their workforce around things like, what is depression? What is anxiety? What is stress? What are the symptoms to look out for? What's my role as a line manager if somebody in my team gets ill? How do I lead and how do I support somebody who might be ill? How do I look, what symptoms do I look for people in my team? If somebody has had to go off work and they've then got to come back, how do I reintegrate them into work? So I think there's a whole bit of what I would call workplace training for all employees around those four areas. And organizations should invest in that. The second area is that I think organizations, and I do this in chronological order, because the second area is that I think organizations need to be campaigning internally more around mental health and communicating differently around mental health. Just like, you know, the metaphor that I gave earlier, you know, I would love to see the whole concept of well-being. You know, if we said that well-being was a driver of your energy, and energy is a very important driver of my performance, probably the most important driver of how I perform, and I've got no energy, I can't perform, and I've got lots of energy, I perform very well. How can we build energy into performance management systems in organizations where we appraise and we develop people and we ask them to look after and enhance their energy and have human conversations around their well-being? So I think there's a whole second stream that organizations need to look at, which is the language that they use around mental health, how they create an aspirational thing around mental health, you know, the physical Nike metaphor, how they get role models and senior people in the organization to share some of their stories. And it might not be a story like mine, but they might have a daughter or a son or a father or a mother that suffered, and they can share that. And so people in the organization start to say, hey, this is normal. You know, my boss will understand if I tell them I'm anxious because their mother suffered from anxiety. So
yeah.
I think there's a whole piece around campaigns, communication, and role modeling. And then the third bit that I think organizations have got to invest in is introducing and giving people the opportunity to participate in practices around mental health, whether that's meditation, mindfulness, yoga. And look, I think a lot of organizations today are doing a lot of that sort of stuff. They tick the box and they say, oh, we're running mindfulness courses and we've got a meditation room. But guess what? Nobody uses it because there's still a stigma. So,
yeah.
You know, you need to deal with one and two first. So you've got to educate and you've got to communicate and raise the awareness. And in doing that, you reduce the stigma. And then once we've reduced the stigma, then we introduce all these practices. We're just like we've always given employees gyms and we've told them about nutrition and sleep and all the rest, let's also give them practices around mental health. But only do that once we've addressed the stigma.
Yeah, it is. It just all comes back to stigma, doesn't it? Because like you say, you know, if you're the only one sat cross-legged in the conference room meditating, there are going to be people walking past and thinking, what on earth is that person doing?
Exactly.
But you know,
well, I've got a real,
but that guy's the one
that
he's not going to be depressed.
Yeah, but I've got a real life story. You know, a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine who does some mindfulness training. So she's doing some training in an organization because this company's just thought, okay, we'll sort out mental health by running some mindfulness courses. And in walks a really senior person into the training at lunchtime and says, what's going on here? And the teacher says, well, I'm teaching mindfulness. And the individual then says, oh, these are the people who can't cope in our organization. Well, guess how many people went on the next mindfulness course? Nobody. Because, you know, they were seen to be weak and because they had to do some mindfulness training. So, you know,
that's
the
shocking.
Education piece hadn't been put in place. Yeah. Shocking. Shocking. But it's
I mean,
real.
The person that said that should be fired, not the people who are going to the mindfulness. That's just terrible.
I know, but, you know.
God, well, but that
know,
is true.
I'm
that's real life, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, sometimes I'm sympathetic with some of that sort of stuff because, you know, people, you know, I mean, if I were to go back to 2007, prior to 2008, when I got ill, I had no understanding of this concept of depression and anxiety. I mean, I remember when I first came to live in this country, people used to say to me, there's a thing called seasonal affects disorder. People get sad over the winter time. And I said, what? People get their mood get influenced by the weather? Don't talk rubbish. You know what I mean? Because I was ignorant. And I just think there's so much ignorance out there that lends people to then make stupid comments like, oh, so these are people who can't cope. So we've got to deal with the ignorance.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Jeff, I want to keep talking with you, but we're going to pause for just a couple of minutes and we're going to listen to the song that you have chosen, which is one of my all-time favourites. Is that okay if we pause for Neil for
cool.
a few moments? So, yeah, we're going to take a break and we're going to listen to Hello Again by Neil Diamond, and then we're going to resume this absolutely fascinating interview afterwards. So, Hello Again by Neil Diamond.
Hello again, hello. Just called to say hello. I couldn't sleep at all tonight, and I know it's late, but I couldn't wait. Hello, my friend, hello. Just called to let you know I think about you every night when I'm here alone and you're there at home. Hello. But I put my heart above my head. We've been through it all, and you love me just the same. And when you're not there, I just need to hear hello, my friend, hello. It's good to meet you so. It's good to love you like I do, and to feel this way when I hear you say hello.
Again by Neil Diamond. It was written by Neil Diamond and Alan Lindgren, that appeared in the 1980 movie called The Jazz Singer. And if you like Neil Diamond and you've not watched that film, you must go and watch it. It's a little bit 1970s, but it is fantastic. And actually, the Jazz Singer album reached multi-platinum status and became Diamond's most successful album to date. And it resulted in three hit songs, which if you like Neil Diamond, you will know. They are America, Love on the Rocks, and Hello Again. So, Jeff, have you seen the Jazz Singer film?
Yeah. Takes me back a number of years, but yes, I have.
Me too. Barclay Flair.
I'm completely useless when it comes to music, but the only music that I love is Neil Diamond. I mean, I know nobody else, but I just love him.
That's the best choice ever. That is my all-time favourite song. I had that played when I was 40 at my birthday party, and everybody thought I was mad, but I don't care. I love Neil. I get it off my mum. She loves Neil Diamond, and I just grew up with him, and he's just like, superb. So yeah. I don't want to sort of deviate from this absolutely fascinating conversation that we're having, and there's just so much still I want to ask, and I know our time is kind of running out. Tell me, how can we measure sustainable improvement of employee well-being? So, you know, once you've got the bosses to actually come online with improving mental wellness in the workplace and trying to break down that stigma, how can we then maintain that those practices are being carried out and employees are being well looked after?
I love that question, Kate, because I'm still formulating my thoughts in that space, because in the last 3 years, as I've gone in and out of organizations, what I've noticed is that this whole concept of employee, let's call it well-being, is just not sticking. So it tends to be given to some junior manager to manage, and it's kind of a bit of a nice to have, and we can have it on our website that we run a few, we have a few well-being courses, and we have a well-being day twice a year, and we have a mental health day once a year, and we do lots and lots of stuff around mental health once a year during Mental Health Week, blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
This concept of well-being is not sticking. And the reason that it's not sticking is because it's still not seen as a strategic imperative to enhancing the success or the performance of the organization.
So where I think
we have to go to now is we have to go to saying that if we all buy the concept of energy as being critical to my performance, so just like to my cell phone or my mobile phone is flat, I cannot use my phone. When my battery as a human being is flat, you get nothing out of me. Now, what is it that charges my battery? I know what charges my cell phone battery is some electricity. What is it that charges my battery so that I have energy to give of my best? And what charges my battery is my well-being at those four levels that we spoke about earlier this evening, my physical, my emotional, my mental, and purpose and meaning. Now, if my well-being charges my energy, energy is a driver of my performance. I want to see organizations putting energy into their performance management and development system so that every twice a year when you have an appraisal with an employee, you will just like currently talk about their skills and their knowledge and their behaviors and their experience as being drivers of their performance. I want line managers to also talk about energy. And if we build it into the overall performance management development system in the organization, and energy is overtly seen as a driver of performance, then we will have everybody beginning to have these conversations around the well-being of people. As a line manager, what is it that we can be doing to help enhance your physical, your emotional, mental, blah, 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 blah. And guess what? In those conversations, I want those to be really simple conversations, which are a lot more human now because I'm talking to a human being. We can only have those conversations once we've addressed the stigma around mental health and emotional health. But let's say we've got this utopia where we have addressed the stigma, where we are talking about, as a line manager, having those conversations. I would like to see, and this is going to sound quite harsh, but just like if somebody in my organization who worked for me, if I said to them, look, you're lacking a particular skill and I would like you to go on a training course so that you get that skill to improve your performance. If in 6 months' time that employee hadn't gone on the training course and got the skill, I would have had quite a harsh conversation with that employee to say, your performance is really bad. Unless you sort this out, you're probably not going to stay here much longer. So go and get that training. I would like to see the same happen with energy. So if I've had a conversation with you 6 months and it's been a really human conversation, I've given you all the support and I said, look, it's really important that you try and get more sleep or that you lose a bit of weight or you put on a bit of weight or you attend to some of the emotional stuff. And I'm not a psychiatrist or a therapist, but I'm this line manager who's supportive and I'm signposting you in the right direction. And if you've gone and you've not done anything to address that aspect of your well-being and therefore your energy, then I have a tough conversation with you. So, you know, this becomes, I think there's got to be personal responsibility and accountability to look after your well-being. And then I think organizations have got to provide the climate and they've got to offer the resources whereby people can go and employ and use some of those resources to enhance their well-being. And it becomes a two-way thing. It's part of my performance, and it now sticks in the organization. And it seemed to be of strategic importance to driving the performance of individuals and the success of the company. And until we get there, I think these well-being initiatives and all this stuff is just going to stay like you said. You know, it's not really sticking. It's kind of, how do we sustain it? How do we make it be there in infinitum? The only way we do that is by building it into, hardwiring it into some of the systems and processes.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. I agree with you on that one. And yeah, I mean, if you were, say, if there's a boss listening in on this show right now, and he's got, it could be a small and medium-sized company, because I think those are the ones that will find it more difficult to implement.
Yep.
Maybe. to implement these strategies, because they perhaps don't have access to the resources that a large corporation would have access to. But, you know, if somebody's there, they're listening here and they're thinking, crikey, this actually applies to me, because I've got some employees in my organization that I know are struggling and I don't know how to help them. Yeah, could you sort of give, I don't know, one, two or three tips that individual might be able to either to lead them to better resources for help, or what could they do?
Yeah. Well, look, the first thing that they've got to do is they need to kind of read up and understand, you know, the drivers of well-being, which we've just spoken about. So, you know, there's a Warwick, Edinburgh University definition of well-being, which is, you know, which is about physical, emotional, mental, and physical. So that's the first thing. Second thing that they need to do is, I think they need to lead for breaking the stigma around mental well-being in their workplace, so that people will feel that they can talk about this. And then the third really practical thing is why not then just take that little framework and say, you know, what could be some questions that I could be asking my people around their physical health? What could be some simple questions around their emotional, their mental, and whether they got purpose and meaning in life? And all we want to do is we just want to start those conversations going. It's a little bit like, you know, when we're trying to create safety cultures in organizations, you'd start every meeting with some conversation around safety. Why don't we just start meetings, all meetings, with a conversation around how are people feeling in this room? Let's just see how people are feeling at a physical, at an emotional, at a mental level. Let's just have that conversation, you know. And look, in time, we can get a little bit more sophisticated around all of this stuff. But it's about starting to have those conversations and then in time saying, okay, can we now build it into some of our appraisal systems? And we can train some of our line managers on how to have those conversations. And guess what, Kate? There are line managers and there are people out there that do this just naturally because they've got what I call emotional intelligence. You know, they notice that one of their employees over for weeks has not been behaving very, you know, their behavior is not normal. It's different. What do? They say, hey, come on, let's go and have a cup of coffee. Tell me what's going on in your life. And people, and so there are line managers out there that do this really well. All I'm wanting to do is get everybody to do this by giving them some really – so maybe find some of those emotionally intelligent line managers in your business and say, how do you do this stuff? How do you have these conversations? And let's start doing it more and more. And by the way, as the CEO, I'm going to ask you to do it in your appraisal conversations that you have with people.
Sure. I'm very, very close friends with two – very high-end CEOs, and they are superb with their workforce. One runs a multi-billion dollar company, and the other one runs a multi-million pound company over in the UK. And but that whole attitude to their workforce is just remarkable. And they've both come from very different backgrounds, but they've both had their own vulnerabilities. And boy, do they work well for their workforce. But, you know, the workforce is loyal to them because they support their workforce. And if there's an issue, it gets addressed. And I just love seeing that. I love it when I meet up with these people because they're just so inspiring. And it's just such a shame that that doesn't happen across the board. Jeff, listen, we're running out of time. We've got about 5 minutes left. So as looking on sort of your life as a whole, going back to your own personal experiences, what would your 80-year-old self give you as advice right now?
Sorry, say that again, Kate. What would?
It is a bit confusing. What would your 80-year-old self give? What advice would your 80-year-old self give your current Jeff right now to go and live your life? I can hear your brain ticking.
Yeah.
What would he say to you?
I think he would say to me, you know, carefully about your definition of success. And is success measured by how much material possessions and wealth you have, or is success measured by what Ralph Emerson once said: if you can just help one person breathe a little easier every day, then that is success. And so I think if I was this 80-year-old, I would probably be saying, Jeff, take your foot off the accelerator, smell the roses, and think about what is it that you could be giving rather than getting. I think Winston Churchill gave some wonderful advice. You know, he said that we earn a living by getting, and we earn a life by giving. And so maybe that would be a bit of advice, would be, you know, how can you go and have a life by giving more?
I love that. Oh, gosh, that makes so much sense as well. Mind you, Winston Churchill did come out with some corkers. So, Jeff, just remind us, how do people connect with you?
At JeffMacDonald1 on Twitter.
Yep.
And you've got my email address, jeffmacdonald90@gmail.com.
Yep.
Those are the two. And then, probably. I'm also on LinkedIn. If people want to connect in, you know, they can find me on LinkedIn.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure that I link every connection up to you in the show notes for today's episode. I so appreciate you coming on the show today. And, wow, I mean, you're just changing the world. So excited to see how everything works out for you, and you're just changing so many people's lives for the good. I love the fact that you're helping to break down the stigma of mental health issues in the workplace, and also just bring it into all of our awarenesses, because it needs to be there. All links to Jeff, me, and this interview will be posted on the Flourish Therapy Facebook page, and you can find that at facebook.com/flourishtherapy.co.uk. They'll also be on my radio show page, which is on my website, which is flourishtherapy.co.uk. Thank you so much, Jeff, for being my guest on the Flourish and Thrive radio show today. And to our listeners, thank you all so much for being here. This is episode 10 of the Flourish and Thrive radio show with me, Kate Hartley, and the truly incredible Jeff MacDonald. And you can find out more about Jeff at openmindshealth.com. And until next time, goodbye from us both. And thank you, Jeff, so much. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Okay, thank you, Kate. Goodbye all.
Yep, we'll see you. I'll meet up with you again soon, Jeff.
I can do anything.
Yeah, okay, cool.
I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.